popular destinations for many of us, but it was a German entrepreneur who's credited with creating the kind of zoo we know today.
It's a sort of a funny name, and some people in the United States probably even know it, a much sort of older generation actually, because there's something called the Hagenbeck-Wallace Circus. And people in Milwaukee who are used to seeing the circus parade will have seen wagons that say Hagenbeck-Wallace Circus. That is a reference to Carl Hagenbeck and his place in sort of the modern exhibition of animals.
Nigel Rothfels has written a book, Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. Also, how do TV sports anchors define their roles? Sports journalists or super fans? We'll talk with Tom Pippins of Channel 6. That's right after the news from NPR. This is At 10 on non-WUWM. I'm Dave Edwards. The modern American zoo is much different than zoos of years gone by. Gone are the heavy bars. Now it's common to see animals lumbering along in spacious green areas, carefully engineered to keep the viewing public and the animals safe and separated. Dr. Nigel Rothfels has written a book chronicling the modern zoo. It's called Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Tell me why you wrote this book in the first place. What got you fascinated about zoos?
Fascination goes back a long, long way, I think, for many people. It does. For me, it was when I was a kid, going to zoos all the time, going through college, going to graduate school, thinking about what I was going to write about for a dissertation in history. I was in the history department at Harvard and wondering what would be a suitable topic. And somebody said, well, do something that you love to look at. It seemed like I could write about zoos. And I was writing about 19th century Germany. And when one wanted to write about animals like I did and zoos like I was thinking about and you were interested in German history, I ended up hitting on this person, Carl Hagenbeck. And it's a sort of a funny name, and some people in the United States probably even know it, a much sort of older generation actually, because there's something called the Hagenbeck-Wallace Circus. And people in Milwaukee who are used to seeing the circus parade will have seen wagons that say Hagenbeck-Wallace Circus. That is a reference to Carl Hagenbeck and his place in sort of the modern exhibition of animals. It was just a few little pieces together, thinking about zoos, thinking about animals, thinking about Germany, and then coming on a topic where I found this person who built a zoo at the beginning of the 20th century, which sort of changed everything in the way we look at animals.
He really got involved in part because he was an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. He was a businessman through and through. His dad was a fishmonger. He had a little fish shop in Hamburg in the 1840s when Carl, young Carl, was born. It was a little sideline business of the company that they would sell sort of funny little animals that had come into the port. That little business began to grow rather quickly in the 1850s and 1860s. When Carl was a 16-year-old, he became the owner of this animal business, this sort of spin-off of his dad's fish business. And by 1880, he is the world leader in selling and buying exotic animals. And if you're a zoo in New York City or in London or in Paris, or in the Far East, and you want something unusual, you call this person up. And you say, look, actually you probably send them a letter instead of the phone, but you say, look, you know, I'm interested in buying an alligator or whatever it is. And he says, well, how big an alligator? not anything else. And he'll get it to you. And he'll deliver it to your door, free shipping.
You know, what's interesting is that now we think of zoos as kind of being part of the public good. They're run by the county. They're run by, you know, different municipalities. This was a guy who was trying to make a buck.
And was very successful at it. When his zoo opened up, the company had already existed for over 40 years. And he... throughout that time had been an animal dealer and had gotten involved in a few other sort of ventures that were animal and not animal related, circuses and the like. And he thought, and at the time too, at the time in the late 19th, early 20th century, zoos were built by cities, or they were built by benevolent societies. In other words, sort of a group of civic leaders, or they were built by a sort of an incorporation of people. People could buy a limited stock, for example, in a zoo. But it was about sort of providing something for the public that would be useful and educational and recreational and things like that. That's not his intention. He wanted to make money. And the company exists today, and it's still privately held, getting on 100 years later. The zoo still exists. It's still owned by the family, and it looks remarkably similar to how it looked when it was first built, when it opened in May of 1907.
When he first got into this business, I mean, what were his contacts like? How was he able to get the animals?
Yeah, well, it's part of the history of Hamburg in a way. This is a lot of people will know, it's a city right on a major port. At the time in the late 19th century, it's a free city, which meant that there was no tariffs going in or out. It was essentially an independent operation, part of the German Empire, but also separate from it in its own way. And so product could come into the city and leave the city's ports without having to pay any tariffs. And it became, in the end of the 19th century, the place, really, along with perhaps some ports in Amsterdam and London and the United States, the place for international shipping. And when ships come in the late 19th century and early 20th century, when ships come from far off places of the world, people tend to sort of bring things along, things that weren't necessarily part of the actual purpose of the trip. You know, there are plenty of occasions where just, you know, a sailor picks up that or this parrot while they're abroad, and they come back and they say, well, who wants to buy it? And this is a person who was standing there, and he had his Asians there, and he said, well, I'll buy it from you. Mm-hmm. That develops rather quickly. He becomes the person who will buy anything. He'll buy the polar bear. He'll buy the elk. He'll buy the alligator that somebody hauls back.
But he could not have just relied on happenstance. I mean, for example, if somebody, you know, ordered the elephant or the alligator, I mean, you know, how do you procure that?
There was, there were two steps, really. I think initially, there were independent operators who went out and said, well, I'll just go and catch everything and bring everything I can back. Actually, the original people who went out weren't catchers, really. They just went and bought things that that local people had already procured. Those people, say about in the 1870s, began to hear about this guy up in Hamburg who would buy everything that they managed to get a hold of. And then Hagenbeck himself, and it's a really interesting moment, says, you know, heck with that. I'll outfit my own expeditions, and I will send my own people and cut out these guys who are independent operators, and I will just send my own people out. I'll equip them, and I'll send them to Egypt, or I'll send them to India, and they'll get everything they can, and they'll bring it back, and I won't have to buy it from them. I'll already own it. Mm-hmm. And instead, I'll just pay them a little bit of money. And that's sort of the beginning, really, of sort of targeted animal collection, you know, where you decide, look, what we really want to get is a blah. And of course, the blahs are things like elephants or hippos or gorillas or something very charismatic for a collection.
I can just imagine what it must have been like, not only capturing these animals and learning how to capture the animals, but doing it in such a way that, you know, the catchers themselves were not at risk.
Well, yeah, I think in general the catchers weren't much risk. The animals were in rather substantial risk, actually.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
It
yeah.
was, you know, I mean, this is like many colonial enterprises, you know, large extractive enterprises. They tend to have a fairly big effect on environments and on things that are, you know, part of the product. So, okay, let's just say you want to go and get yourself a big shipment of animals from what is now Eritrea. You can send your people down, and they can find their way to a little city someplace, and they can set up what they call an animal station or something, just basically a couple of huts with some places to store animals. Contact some local people and say, look, you know, anything you bring to us, we'll buy. The initial people weren't actually catchers themselves. They didn't go out on horseback or something and go and catch stuff. They relied on people who were already in place and who would take the risk themselves, and they would pay them for them. Then you would assemble, a collection of 50, 60, 80 animals or something of different kinds from that part of the world. You might have a bunch of ostriches and some little lion cubs and maybe some little elephants and a lot of young animals, right? Because young animals are a lot easier to transport than adult animals. Okay, so right off the bat, right, you have young animals. Well, the way you sort of catch young animals at the time, frankly, is you go out and you kill the adults and you take the young ones away and you bring them back to some sort of station and you take care of them for a while until you have enough animals, and then you begin a walk to the Red Sea, which will take quite a while with those animals. And then you ship them to Europe. And along the way, there's a sort of substantial loss. This could be a venture where half to two-thirds of the animals would die before they actually reached Europe. Profitable.
You end up with this Noah's Ark kind of deal coming over too, I imagine.
Yeah,
quite a little collection.
Yeah, you end up with a boat where you're hoping very much that it's not Noah weather, because when you're crossing the Mediterranean, if you have some really nasty weather and you've got all these animals flopping around on the deck, you could lose a few more animals, and everyone has a cost, and that's one of the problems.
I think about how different that is to today. I mean, now, we're so conscious of the way animals are treated in zoos that, thinking back to just how the animals were captured and transported, would we tolerate that today?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure, actually. Because obviously the reality is that most of the large animals, the mammals, of course, in zoos, and I say most, I mean probably 90%, are coming through domestic arrangements. That is, somebody breeds one and one zoo sells an animal to another animal. And of course, the animals that are protected by the CITES Convention, the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, those animals are very difficult to get in the wild anymore, which isn't to say that there aren't animals, especially in things like the large saltwater aquariums and things, which aren't coming from the wild. So there's still an element here.
We're going to take a break. When we get back, I want to continue our conversation talking just about how the animals were exhibited back then versus today as well. The book is called Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. We'll continue our conversation in a moment on WUWM's At 10.
This portion of programming on 89.7 WUWM, sponsored by the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, helping individuals and families manage their philanthropy through donor-advised funds, on the web at greatermilwaukeefoundation.org.
Anxiety disorders range from the run-of-the-mill driving stress to vague but chronic notions of worldwide doom, and anxiety's on the rise, we're told. According to the National Mental Health Association, 19 million Americans suffer from an anxiety disorder, 13% of us. We'll explore why this is happening and treatment options on the next Todd Munt Show.
The Todd Munt Show is this morning at 11 o'clock, after our At 10 show this morning, WUWM.
Back with more of At 10 on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're talking today with Nigel Rothfels. He is director of the Edison Initiative at UW Milwaukee, which we could, spend another half hour talking about at some point. But today we're talking about his book. It's called Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. You know, when I look back at even, reading your book here and thinking back to certainly other books and pictures that I have seen of zoos of that era, they were so much different. And even, when I was a youngster growing up and visiting the zoos, it was the big, heavy bars, the animals that sat there because it looked like they were in a prison cell. But that was more accepted back then in terms of the way zoos were really designed.
Yeah, well, that's an aesthetic thing, right? I mean, that's the really important element there is that there are people, and I listen to them, zoo historians, who would say, well, you know, a lot of those old exhibits with the bars might be seen as quite nice for an animal. I mean, some of them are quite large, actually. And so it's, you know, there's a clearly sort of an aesthetic thing there. We don't like to see bars very much. And I think that's the thing that Carl Hagenbeck realized when he started showing animals is that people, this is the end of the 19th century, people were very uncomfortable, began to become increasingly uncomfortable with looking at animals from behind bars. And he said, well, what can I do about it? And so he came up with this, you know, sort of spectacular way of exhibiting animals that separated the individual, well, in his case, groups of animals from with moats. And it's something that we're all used to, and it looks now very sort of natural. At the time, it was a spectacular thing, you know. When his first, when people first walked into his zoo, and this is in 1907, and they stepped out on what was called the main panorama, what they saw in front of them was a small pond, and in that pond would be little waterfowl and ducks, and maybe a few flamingos, and then beyond that would be a little beach, and there'd be some small antelope walking around on that beach. They wouldn't see that there was a moat between that area and another exhibit, which had larger hoofstock, things like zebras and eland milling about. They wouldn't see the moat behind that exhibit, but they would see beyond that a group of lions in a grotto, and above that grotto they would see these cliffs rising up, and in those cliffs would be vultures, and there would be different kinds of mountain goats running around on these cliffs. So it was a pretty spectacular scene, and it was obviously one that was really designed around the visitor, right? It's not that he had designed an exhibit which liberated the animals, although it looked like he had, right? I mean, the effect here was to say, look, you know, what we've done is freed the animals from the cages.
It was pretty sophisticated, really, in planning.
Yeah, it was a remarkable place. And this is why when people go there today, they say, it looks so modern. 100 years later, it still looks like exactly what we would want to see in a zoo. And it's exactly, in fact, what zoos today aspire to create. When you go out to the Milwaukee County Zoo and you look at the old part of the zoo with the African waterhole, and then the South American exhibit and the African plains exhibit where the cheetahs are in the background and the impalas are in the front, those are straight out of Hagenbeck's book.
So he created kind of shows. He put the entertainment value into the zoos.
He understood entertainment. I think for many people, one of the complicated features of this man was that, of course, he exhibited for many, 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 many years indigenous people from all over the world in his and in other people's or other major zoological gardens of Europe.
How did he do that?
Well, it depends on the show. It depends on the people who are being exhibited. There are specific cases where you could contact a colonial administrator, or in the United States, an official at the Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, rather, and you could contract, and you could say, look, what I'd like to have is a group of Native American performers come to Germany for a tour of, say, 2-3 months in the summer of 1880 or something, a random sort of date. And I'd like those people to come, and what I'd like them to do is perform some dances, and I'd like to have them show their crafts, and we could lay all that out in a contract, and we would contact some people, for example, Lakota Sioux group, and bring them over, and they could sign a contract, and they would be performers. That's one model. Another model, it gets a little bit more problematic, where you just essentially find a group of people and grab them and throw them in your boat and haul them off to Europe.
So they probably weren't paid any better than the animals were.
I think in some cases they were paid what to many people at the time would have been considered rather extraordinary money. And there are quite a few cases that we know of where people would come back year after year after year to do this gig. I mean, it's a performance gig, and there's a there's good reason to want to go to Europe and make some money and bring it back and bring back some technology with you. And you know, people, there are good reasons if you're a performer to want to be involved in a business like this. But it's also a little problematic. I think we all understand that from the audience perspective and from the person on the other side of this exhibit moment, it's very different staring at a person at a zoo than it is staring at an animal.
You also write about the fascination with photography of nudes as well.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the aspects of being able to look at people in the zoo is that we don't, even today, except when we watch television, we don't really have opportunities to stare at people. We tell our children not to stare. Well, this was an occasion in the 19th century when you could go to the zoo and you could stare at people. And those people very often, especially in the exhibits that were over the summer, very often didn't have many clothes on. This for a great many people was part of the attraction of the show. I mean, and of course many photographs were taken of these people, and a lot of these photographs ended up in what would be considered sort of a black market pornography industry. A lot of the photographs ended up in just anthropological literature, and were recycled over and over and over and over again till today. They're still used.
It's so amazing to think that society would permit that. I mean, when we place that in the context of today, for example.
There was an exhibit this last summer in Belgium, of a group of people from West Africa, from the Congo, at a zoo. It was extremely controversial. People were very upset. This is saying, you know, we are sitting here looking at people at the zoo. This is something deeply wrong about this. The people on exhibit themselves said, look, this is the same thing we do when you come to visit us. You come to our village, you give us a little bit of money. We're just bringing it to you, and we would like to take the money back with us. There's still elements of this, right? I mean, there are elements of this when we watch daytime television, in a sense, and we see exhibitions of people and people exhibiting themselves in ways that we might be uncomfortable looking at if they were sitting across the wall, you know, across some sort of barrier from us. But this is the pleasure that we get, or the satisfaction of our curiosity that we get when we look at people, mm-hmm. Is at the heart of something like this.
Were zoos more popular back at the turn of the century than they are today, do you think?
Wow, that's a fabulous question. Well, we know that zoos are extremely popular today, right? I mean, more people go to zoos than they go to any sporting event. There were some times, if you look at photographs of the late 19th century, and if you look at the photographs of the major zoos of the major cities in, say, Berlin or Paris or London or New York City in the late 19th century on a beautiful day, and people can barely move, right? I mean, they are just packed in there. I think they're probably, they've always been very, very, very popular. The audience has shifted some. The audience has become a lot younger since the 19th century. The 19th century, it's mostly adults who are there, and you see sort of a smattering of children here and there. Now, of course, it's people take their children there. That's the point of going. There are, of course, people who go who are adults like me. but, you know, I'm at the zoo every 10 days because I have a 3-year-old.
Sure. No, and zoos are a wonderful place because we all have a fascination with animals. And, of course, now the animals are much more exotic, you know, at most zoos than they were years ago because of available resources. But it doesn't seem that, for example, the circus is as popular today as the circus was decades ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, the circus is a much more controversial space, isn't it?
Yeah, why
is that?
Especially
with exhibiting animals.
Is it just the controversy, or have circuses kind of fallen out of favor for other reasons?
Well, the controversy, right, has to do with whether people think it's somehow degrading to animals or somehow degrading to people to watch animals perform in this kind of setting. Now, the other part of the controversy is that there's a claim that the animals don't want to do this, right? That in order to be exhibited in a circus the way they are, that they must be coerced in some way or another. And there's, you know, on a fairly regular basis, we'll hear something about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's been a big hit on circuses. And when you look at the success, the increasing success of non-animal circuses, right, the spectacular Cirque du Soleil things, right, then you can see that, look, you know, the form itself is not really as controversial as the animals. And yet, I think a lot of people would say, look, you know, if you're going to go see Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, there better be some elephants. I mean, we're paying for it. And I'm sure that's how Ringling Brothers would see it as well. But they have fallen out of favor, and it does have to do with some changing ideas in our culture about what is both appropriate for animals to be doing and what's appropriate for us to be looking at animals doing.
You know, I'm not going to let you get away without a discussion of what your favorite zoos are that you've been to, because I suspect that you've been to more than most people have, given your fascination.
Yeah, well, it's been a hobby for a long, long time. I have a feeling, I've always sort of felt that, you know, you could go to a zoo and find out a great deal about a culture. I remember in the pre-wall coming down days of Berlin, going to the West Berlin Zoo and the East Berlin Zoo. And, I mean, these are zoos separated by a few miles, and both being built by governments that really wanted to show they had the best thing going. I mean, East Berlin Zoo was a jewel of zoos in Eastern Europe. Very, very different kinds of places. And I always thought, well, okay, this would be kind of interesting. You know, what about just going to zoos to visit, you know, a culture? And you can do it because they're all over the place.
Thank you very much for coming in and talking
with
us. Nigel Rothfeld has written Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. He's also director of the Edison Initiative at UWM.